Science and Wisdom Live is a project of Jamyang London Buddhist Center, a non-profit organization. Please consider supporting us with a donation to help us keep our podcasts and videos free and ad-free. To support us now, please visit our website at scienceandwisdomlive.com. This episode is an excerpt of one of our Science and Wisdom dialogues. To listen to the full recording, please follow the link in the podcast description.
We wanted to start out talking to you about science and wisdom because you've worked closely with His Holiness the Dalai Lama for many years in dialogues with scientists all over the world, including, of course, your role as the chair of the Mind and Life Institute. So could you talk a little bit about why you and His Holiness have put so much effort into engaging with scientists?
I mean, to be frank, it's not me. It's really His Holiness. And my engagement with scientists happened to be, you know, to take place because of my service to His Holiness as His principal interpreter. But to be honest, you know, at the beginning, my interest with respect to contemporary Western culture was primarily more in philosophy and literature. I wasn't that keen on science, partly because, you know, I grew up in the monastery and, the science to me seemed very factual and, quite technical. But, you know, having become His Holiness's principal English interpreter, I realized fairly soon that engagement with science and scientists was a major interest on his part and that there was a deeper objective underlying his interest. His Holiness has had, you know, you're all aware, had long-term friendship with the key figures of 20th century science, Karl Popper, for instance, and David Bohm. I was particularly present at several, you know, informal dialogues between His Holiness and David Bohm. So, of course, and then, you know, I mean, once I have appreciated deeply His Holiness's broader sort of, you know, view and the objective and the context in which this dialogue is taking place, of course, then my own engagement became deeper,
What have scientists learned from Tibetan Buddhism's understanding of the mind through all of these dialogues?
The language of science is that of math and description in scientific language. So, and that imposes, and that has definitely a lot of strengths of rigor, you know, intersubjectivity, verifiability, duplicability, and all of that. But it also imposes a certain restrictions and limitations, which is the inability to capture what one could argue is the essential character of mind, which is the subjectivity. Science in general, and particularly scientists who are interested in studying consciousness, have really been able to have a more critical self-understanding of the limitations of current science and the challenges, you know, that the study of consciousness poses to science itself. Because the Buddhist tradition is so rich in the, you know, mental training practices, the, you know, scientists and the clinical disciplines have the ability to really look at various types of applications and their effect and their connection with mental well-being. And there, I think, even though I characterize this as less revolutionary, but in some ways it is very revolutionary because what is happening is that, you know, for the first time, science, you know, science and clinical science particularly, is able to develop and embrace therapeutic techniques that really rely heavily on the person's own, you know, agency of turn, you know, helping to train, helping the patients to turn their own mind into an ally towards promotion of their own mental well-being. So this is a really quite a radical step for clinical science, which tends to rely heavily on pharmacological interventions. So in these areas, I think, you know, the engagement between Buddhism and science, and more specifically between His Holiness and the scientist, have had a huge impact, you know, at the cultural practice level as well.
I'm curious if you can talk about how, you know, your Buddhist practice, His Holiness's Buddhist practice and teachings, how has science affected your side of the equation, of the Buddhist side?
Although the basic intuition of the early Buddhist texts seem to be spot on, which is there is no beginning, and the universe is in a perpetual evolution and destruction. And then the destruction goes through a temporal stages of heating up. This mm-hmm. broad structure or pattern of understanding the evolution seems to be fairly spot on and, you know, close to the way in which current astronomy, understands, physics and astronomy understands. But when it comes to the specific evolution of our cosmos and life on Earth, then the Darwinian evolutionary theory gives a lot more richness in detail to the content and the sort of the connection between, organisms like plants and so on, and between animals, the sentient creatures. And so that whole description is very rich, and there is no condition in Buddhism in incorporating these. So I think that on the actual practice, I know His Holiness is a big fan of quantum physics. And I think he knows far more about quantum physics than I do. I prepared just enough so that I can be in service when it comes to translating for him, so that at least I know the kind of direction that the presenters are going, you know. But beyond that, I mean, His Holiness had taken tutorial from, you know, von Weizsäcker, the, you know, famous German physicist. So he knows a lot more. And then His Holiness seems to take quantum physics really quite seriously, particularly the kind of the role of observer in, you know, being constitutive part of reality itself. Mm-hmm. All of this. Clearly there is, you know, some benefit that can be brought in. And also I've heard His Holiness speak of how the physics explanation of the dynamic nature of the physical world can be very helpful for understanding the Buddhist teachings on impermanence. Again, bringing a lot more richness and concreteness to the actual description of the principle of impermanence.
There's also this, I think, a similarity between science and the specifically the Nalanda tradition of Buddhism that Tibetan Buddhism comes from, with the emphasis on critical thinking and debate. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the role of critical thinking in, you know, your strain of Buddhism, the one that you were trained in and you're a teacher in, and how it's similar or different from scientific criticism and skepticism.
In order for for a Dharma practice to really have an impact, it needs to be internalized. Mm-hmm. You know, it's only through internalizing the teaching that there can be a real impact. But the internalization process would involve, you know, processing whatever teaching you have received. Mm-hmm. And that processing cannot be done by someone else for you. It has to be done by yourself. Yeah. And so some element of critical thinking, whether we call it critical thinking or critical reflection or contemplation or, you know, or application of a disciplined mind, whatever language we use, is kind of assumed. And then the Buddha himself has this famous example of the raft. You know, the raft is necessary to cross the river, but once you have crossed it, you don't carry on your back, you know? So in the same way, but without the raft, you can't cross the river. You know, even though in the end you need to get rid of the, you know, raft, you know, once you reach the other shore, but that does not mean justify getting rid of the raft in the first place, you know, right from the beginning. So I think here the Nalanda tradition, which is powerfully represented in the Tibetan tradition by Jesongkhapa's teaching, is to really, you know, say that disciplined application of thought is what leads us to what Tsongkhapa calls ascertainment, you know, nyepa. And ascertainment, it is through deepening our ascertainment, making it clear, making it more enduring, making it stronger, that we will then be able to counter its opposites, you know, all the distorted perception of reality.
I'm curious if you can reflect on how much a Buddhist practice can be validated by science. Do you think there are limits to what science can understand about our inner reality?
We don't expect science to prove rebirth. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't expect science to prove emptiness, even though it may be able to. But and there, I think you respect the integrity of the two sides, the Buddhist tradition and its agenda, its objectives, and science, its agenda, its discipline, its tradition. And that, I think, is a healthy way where there is a genuine mutual respect and dialogical encounter and no urge to reduce the other into one's own paradigm.
I was really struck by a lecture you gave at George Washington University a couple of years ago that I was watching recently, where you talk about how ethics is optional in Western society and how part of, you know, your goal in your life is to maybe make ethics less of an option and more of a requirement in culture and society. Can you talk a little bit about that and maybe, you know, what society might look like if it integrated ethics and compassion more into our culture or even our laws? I mean, and is your role in the Compassion Institute, where you're the co-founder there, is that part of your of fulfilling this goal?
My own personal kind of vision for Compassion Institute is to really help make real part of His Holiness's vision for the world, which is to find ways to make compassion active and real, in not just in individual human lives, but actually in society. Mm-hmm. And one of the things about compassion is that increasingly, and this is one area where His Holiness has made a huge contribution, which is to naturalize the language of compassion. Because up until recently, compassion is seen as a moral value, it's part of religious teaching, you know, so, and you know, sort of quite removed from science and quite removed from everyday human kind of, you know, condition. And His Holiness has made really great efforts to, in some sense, sort of extricate the compassion and the language around it from religion, from traditional religion, mm-hmm. particularly, and from even from morality, moral language, and to ground it as a fundamental aspect of human nature, human condition. Effective neuroscience, which is a study of emotions from a neuroscientific perspective, is a new field. And now there is, you know, growing appreciation of the social dimension of human nature. And there's something called social neuroscience. So it's a science itself is progressing. And part of the reason why it has taken long is when it comes to social aspects of the human being, like compassion and so forth, then you have to understand these only in the context of relationality. Mm. The more science is able to find correlation for specific mental states, the more it becomes easier to then study it, refine the concept, and then find a way to, you know, apply it in the context of interventions and therapeutic practices. Mm.